So, picture a team of engineers, right? And they're staring at a monitoring dashboard in just absolute horror.
Oh, man.
Yeah, they're watching a critical production database just get systematically shredded. And why? Because some shiny new AI agent with unverified tool access just hallucinated a drop table command.
Right. And that's the nightmare scenario.
Totally. Or think about an enterprise burning like millions of dollars on this beautiful AI proof of concept, only for their chief information security officer to take one look at the architecture and just.
Throw the whole project straight in the trash.
Exactly, straight into the
Which
trash.
is honestly the daily reality of this whole generative AI hype cycle right now. I mean, we have this pervasive fantasy in the industry that you just need to hire a quote unquote prompt whisperer.
Right.
Like someone who just types a few lines of natural language, and suddenly, boom, a large language model effortlessly builds a flawless, secure application.
But, you know, if you're listening to this deep dive, you already know better. You're likely a hiring manager or maybe a platform architect or a senior engineer at a frontier AI company.
Yeah, you see the reality.
You know that the second you try to take these models out of some sterile, you know, local testing environment and put them into a highly regulated enterprise, the magic trick completely falls apart.
Oh, it shatters. You hit context window limits immediately.
Yep.
You slam into security boundaries. You've got agents hallucinating APIs that don't even exist. I mean, to actually ship this stuff to real users, you don't need a magician. You really need a civil engineer.
Which perfectly brings us to the core mission of today's deep dive. We are looking for concrete proof that someone can actually build and ship safe, production-grade agentic systems, but at an enterprise scale.
Right.
So to do that, we're tearing into the public runtime site, the highly detailed technical essays, and the project portfolio of Jeremy Johnson.
Yeah, and his official title is Principal AI Engineering Tech Lead. But honestly, going through his essays, that title really kind of undersells the whole philosophy behind his work.
How so?
Well, Jeremy operates on this very specific premise that the software is never just the software. Like the model itself is just this tiny piece of the puzzle.
Right.
The real work, the hard stuff, is all about clear boundaries, intense observability, and just building systems that can survive a collision with a messy, unpredictable organization.
Okay, let's unpack this because before we can really look at the massive enterprise systems he built at places like Data Robot, we first need to understand how he builds on a microscopic level.
Yeah, his local setup.
Exactly. His personal workflow is basically a miniature version of his entire enterprise philosophy. Like looking at his essay on the agentic SDLC, the software development lifecycle, he completely rejects this prevailing idea of treating coding agents as just, you know, a faster text editor.
Yeah, he treats them as distinct, specialized workers inside an actual software delivery factory. Because in the early days of AI coding, and I mean, honestly, a lot of developers still do this today, you'd use agents in a very linear way. You give a single agent this massive task, you wait around, you get a giant diff back.
And it
So,
spent hours trying to fix it.
exactly. You spend hours cleaning up its mistakes. And Jeremy quickly realized that this doesn't actually save time, right? It just shifts the bottleneck.
Right. So you stop typing, but you start drowning in review overhead and just managing all that context.
Precisely.
Yeah.
So to fix that, he built this personal workspace model that he calls OpenClaw.
But wait, if you move away from just one massive agent and instead you have like four or five different agents all working on the same code base simultaneously, how do you stop them from constantly overwriting each other or, you know, just forgetting the original goal? It sounds like total chaos.
Well, it would be chaos, honestly, if you didn't have a really rigid state management system.
Okay.
So Jeremy uses these role-separated agents. He's got an architect agent that just decomposes the feature into steps. Then there's a coder agent that is strictly bounded to making specific changes, and a reviewer agent looking for regressions.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and even a babysitter agent that basically just watches the continuous integration pipelines and nags the system for code reviews.
That's incredible.
But the real mechanism that makes all this work together is how they communicate.
Right, because they aren't just sharing a chat thread.
No. They share state through standard version-controlled markdown files sitting right on the disk.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, files like todo.md or current_task.md. Jeremy makes this great point that without a persistent written memory of daily lessons and regressions, you end up with what he calls a fresh amnesiac session every morning.
A fresh amnesiac session. That's a great phrase.
It really is.
Yeah.
Because otherwise, the agent just forgets why a critical design decision was made the day before.
Right.
So by forcing the agents to read and write state to these standard markdown files, the workspace isn't just some fragile chain of prompts. It's an inspectable deterministic history that a human can audit at any time.
Which brings up a really critical point about safety, I think. Because if you're operating this whole assembly line of agents generating code, a human cannot manually review every single token they produce. It's impossible.
No way.
And Jeremy actually writes in his notes that evils are infrastructure, not artifacts.
Yeah, and think about the speed at which AI can generate code. I mean, it can introduce these really subtle, catastrophic bugs at machine speed.
Right.
So therefore, your protection mechanisms, they also have to operate at machine speed.
Mm-hmm.
A manual code review process from a human engineer is just way too slow.
So what does machine speed protection actually look like in his workflow?
It looks like layered automated kill switches.
Okay.
He relies heavily on feature flags that can just turn off a rogue feature in 60 seconds without needing a full redeploy.
That's smart.
And he uses these 60-second synthetic smoke tests that are constantly running in the background just to make sure the core paths aren't broken.
Hmm.
When you transition from being a programmer to being the operator of an agentic system, you're essentially building the control planes that catch the AI when it inevitably drifts off course.
It sounds like moving from being, you know, a solo carpenter using a really fast power drill to suddenly managing the entire robotic assembly line. Like, you're no longer typing the code. You are the operator of the factory.
That is the exact mental shift you have to make.
So, okay, managing a personal robotic assembly line in a local OpenClaw workspace, that makes sense. But taking that philosophy and dropping it into a huge enterprise environment with extreme security constraints, that is a massive leap.
Oh, totally.
Let's transition to his recent work at DataRobot, specifically the Global Model Context Protocol, or MCP.
Yeah, this is a perfect example of his whole philosophy scaling up. So yeah. DataRobot had this massive architectural hurdle, right? Mm. Their public REST API surface is enormous.
Right.
It is roughly 4 megabytes of open API specifications.
4 megabytes of just specs. And, you know, if you're managing a platform team right now, ask yourself, how much of your context window are you wasting just trying to explain your internal APIs to a large language model?
Exactly.
If you hand a 4 megabyte tool catalog to an LLM, you just blow past your context limits instantly.
Oh, absolutely. The token cost goes through the roof, the latency makes the application completely unusable, and the model will inevitably start hallucinating API endpoints that do not exist.
It's a disaster. So how did he handle it?
Well, Jeremy bypassed that entirely. He designed a gateway inspired by Cloudflare's code mode pattern.
Okay, Cloudflare code mode.
Right. So instead of giving the agent this bloated list of thousands of tools, he gave the agent a tiny, highly optimized semantic search surface.
Oh, I see.
The agent searches for what it needs to accomplish. And then instead of making a REST call directly, it is actually allowed to write and run arbitrary Python code against the full DataRobot SDK.
Wait, hold on. Letting an AI agent write and execute arbitrary Python code inside a secure enterprise environment?
Right.
That is an InfoSec nightmare. Any CISO would shut that down immediately.
They absolutely would, unless the infrastructure surrounding that execution was completely bulletproof. Because this code isn't just running naked on some shared server. Jeremy built a highly secure sandbox. Every single time the agent executes code, it spins up a per-call Kubernetes job.
Oh, wow. So it's completely isolated from the rest of the system.
Completely isolated and heavily, heavily restricted. The Kubernetes job is paired with an Envoy proxy and the Open Policy Agent, or OPA.
Okay, let's break that down, because those are serious, heavy enterprise tools. How do Envoy and OPA actually stop the AI from doing something malicious, like, I don't know, exfiltrating customer data to some random server?
Right, so Envoy acts as the traffic cop. It intercepts every single network request trying to leave that Kubernetes pod.
Right.
But Envoy isn't smart on its own. It asks OPA, which is the brain, what to do. OPA evaluates the request against a super strict set of rules. It asks, is this request going to the permitted internal DataRobot API? Yes. Is it trying to reach an external IP address out on the public internet? No. Block it immediately.
That's brilliant.
The agent is physically incapable of sending data where it shouldn't. And to make sure this whole sandbox thing doesn't just ruin the user experience with lag, he engineered the base Docker image all the way down to 15 megabytes.
Why does 15 megabytes matter so much?
Latency. Think about it. If the agent decides to run code, the human user is already sitting there waiting.
Right.
If Kubernetes takes 5 seconds to pull some heavy image and spit up a pod. You just added infrastructure latency on top of the LLM generation latency.
And the product just feels broken.
Exactly. But a 15 megabyte image guarantees a sub 200 millisecond cold start. The sandbox spins up so fast, it actually feels native to the agent's thought process.
That's wild. But I do need to push back on something here. I was reading his project notes on this exact gateway, and he mentions that the centerpiece of this was a massive pull request.
Ah, yes.
He titled it Feet Dad Sandboxed Code Execution via K8's Jobs, and it was 28,000 lines of code across 214 files.
Yep, 28,000 lines.
If I'm a hiring manager looking at an engineer's track record, a 28,000-line PR sets off massive alarm bells. I mean, that sounds like bloated architecture, or at the very least, a total review nightmare for his peers.
What's fascinating here is understanding why that PR had to be massive and how it contrasts with his other work.
Okay.
You cannot piecemeal a secure sandbox threat model. You can't just ship the Kubernetes job spec on Monday and then the proxy configurations on Wednesday and the open API validators on Friday.
Oh, because it's vulnerable during that time.
Exactly. The walls of the fortress have to go up all at once to ensure security. That 28,000-line PR was the heavy load-bearing concrete required to let these agents operate safely.
That makes a lot of sense.
But if you think he just likes writing bloated code for the fun of it, you have to look at his lean testing initiative at DataRobot, which was just a couple of years earlier.
Wait, is that the burn the boats PR?
That's the one.
Huh.
He took this legacy end-to-end test suite that was taking, get this, 458 hours of execution time per day across the entire engineering org.
That is insane.
Right, because end-to-end tests are notoriously slow. They spin up the entire universe, the database, the front end, the back end, literally just to test a single button click.
Right.
So Jeremy redesigned the whole test pyramid around contract tests.
Meaning instead of spinning up the whole universe, a contract test just verifies the agreed upon handshake between two isolated services.
Exactly. It literally just checks if the API request and response match the expected format. It runs in milliseconds.
Wow.
And once those contract tests were in place, Jeremy pushed a single PR called Burn the Boats that deleted almost 16,000 lines of end-to-end tests.
So he just wiped them out.
Wiped them out. He reduced test execution time by 85%, saved massive amounts of infrastructure costs, and they had zero customer regressions.
That's an incredible flex.
He fundamentally understands when an architecture requires heavy, complex concrete and when it just requires ruthless pruning.
So, okay, a Kubernetes sandbox protects the internal enterprise API from a rogue AI agent. That's great. But APIs are, you know, the predictable. What happens when the AI system collides with the most unpredictable factor of all? An unmotivated, messy human user.
Ah, yes. Human.
Exactly. And that's the exact problem he tries to solve with Swolby, which is his applied AI product.
Swolby is such a brilliant case study in product judgment. It's an AI fitness coach. But the whole architecture entirely rejects the standard app model.
Right.
It is SMS first. It lives entirely inside your text messages.
Which is product rationale for that is just so sharp. He notes that most fitness products assume motivation starts when you log into their dashboard.
Which it doesn't.
No. People don't need another dashboard to look at when they feel guilty. They need an intervention at the exact moment of behavioral friction. Like you're sitting on the couch, you're debating skipping the gym, and a text message buzzes in your pocket.
Yep.
SMS is exactly where the drop-off happens.
And under the hood, Swolby is serving as Jeremy's absolute agent-driven development lab.
What's the stack look like?
He uses a very serious production stack here. It's Python, FastAPI, AWS DynamoDB, Twilio for all the SMS routing, Stripe for payments.
Okay, real tools.
Real tools.
Yeah.
But because the blast radius of a side project is small enough, he can really push his agentic workflow to its absolute limit. This whole product is largely being built by agent identities inside his OpenClaw workspace.
Right, the agents we talked about earlier.
Exactly. He actually has agents named Zorg and HappyClaw agent.
Yeah.
And if you look at the commit history, I mean, in March 2026 alone, there was a burst of 12,262 commits authored by these agents.
Okay, I have to be honest here. If I saw a developer push 1,200 commits in a single month, I wouldn't think they were some 10x genius. I'd think they were thrashing.
Right.
I would assume they were just using production as their personal debugging sandbox and throwing spaghetti at the wall to see what sticks.
And honestly, in a traditional CI/CD pipeline, you would be absolutely right.
Right.
That volume of commits usually implies a messy, unsquashed history and just a lot of broken builds. But remember the workspace model we discussed earlier?
The boundaries.
Right. These commits aren't going straight to main. They are bounded, isolated, and governed by the architect and babysitter agents. The high volume is a feature of machine speed iteration. It's not a bug of sloppy human coding. But Jeremy actually agrees with you that the commits themselves really aren't the point.
Right, because he has this mantra for Swolby. He says, agent evil should measure behavior, not vibes.
Which is such a critical distinction. Yeah. Most people evaluate an AI by reading its chat transcripts, like, does it sound friendly? Does the workout plan look realistic?
Here's where it gets really interesting, because evaluating an AI coach just by reading its transcripts is like hiring a chef by reading their recipe instead of tasting the food.
Oh, that's a perfect analogy.
Right. Swolby doesn't test if the AI sounded nice. It tests if the user actually ate the meal and went to the gym.
And that is the only evaluation that actually matters. The evaluation framework is entirely wired into the operational loops.
Okay.
Did the AI successfully get the user to log a workout in the database? Did the user respond to the onboarding text, or did they just ignore it? Did they avoid canceling their Stripe subscription this month?
The behavior.
Exactly. The SMS surface removes all the sort of decorative product theater. The AI's generated response has to earn its place in the text thread, and the evils check for actual measurable human behavior change.
It's just a completely pragmatic way to view AI.
Yeah.
And that pragmatism, you know, the data robot Kubernetes sandboxing, the Swolby behavioral evil is the open claw factory floor. Where does that deep understanding of system constraints even come from?
Yeah, that's the big question.
Because looking at his resume, that clearly didn't start with large language models.
Oh, not at all. If you want to understand his approach to frontier AI, you really have to look at the historical foundation he built over the last decade.
Let's dig into that background a bit. Because way back in 2012, he was a founder and an author of the original RealPython Kickstarter book.
Right.
They set a goal of $3,500 and ended up raising over $50,000 from almost 1,500 backers.
Mm-hmm.
He wrote the book on advanced web development with Django.
That is massive.
Yeah, and that proves a huge amount of developer empathy. He knows how to teach and explain deeply technical concepts, which completely explains why his internal engineering enablement talks at DataRobot are so effective.
Absolutely. But then look at his time as the lead senior software developer for the 4D Nucleome Data Portal over at Harvard Medical School.
Oh, right.
This was in Peter J. Park's lab. He wasn't just building basic web apps. He was building systems to manage incredibly complex genomics and microscopy metadata.
What does building biological metadata systems actually teach a software engineer, though?
Oh, it teaches you the absolute necessity of rigorous data models.
Okay.
In genomics, you are dealing with these massive, complex data sets where a single schema error can literally invalidate months of scientific research.
Oh, wow.
You cannot fake your way through microscopy metadata. You have to ensure that the search interfaces and back-end services are meticulously structured. It basically breeds a paranoia about data integrity.
Makes sense. And then before Harvard, he built and ran SoftWorks Consultancy in Malaysia for an entire decade.
Yeah, 10 years.
He grew it to a 15-person firm acting as managing director, and he delivered bespoke software for some massive enterprise clients. We're talking airlines like AirAsia, automotive giants like BMW, and central banks like Bank Negara.
Huge stakes.
Yeah, and he ran the whole show architecture, sales, hiring, performance testing.
If we connect this to the bigger picture,
mm-hmm.
Jeremy refers to this collective decade of enterprise delivery as scar tissue.
Scar tissue.
Yeah, because when you run a consultancy for 10 years, you learn a very hard truth. The architecture diagram is never the whole story.
The architecture diagram is just the fantasy.
Exactly. The real system includes the shrinking budgets, mm-hmm. the overwhelming support load, the client politics, and just the visceral, real-world cost of being wrong in production.
Right.
Think about what happens when a back-end system goes down at a major airline like AirAsia.
Mm.
It's not just an interesting bug that you can toss in the next sprint to fix.
No.
Flights are delayed.
Mm.
Thousands of passengers are stranded. Millions of dollars are lost. It is a full-blown crisis.
So what does this all mean? If you're that hiring manager or senior engineer listening to this right now, how does a decade of scar tissue from Harvard Medical School and a Malaysian software consultancy translate to the AI platform you are trying to build today?
It's a direct translation.
Exactly. It translates directly to Jeremy's core belief that sandboxing is a product feature. It is the exact reason why he obsesses over 15 megabyte Docker images, 60-second kill switches, and super strict rollback paths. He brings a decade of bruising enterprise realism to the frontier of AI. He doesn't just want the model to be smart. He demands that the system surrounding the model is indestructible.
And that is the ultimate takeaway here. When you review Jeremy Johnson's public site, you are not looking at a list of generic AI hype or novelty GitHub repos.
Right.
You're looking at concrete, verifiable proof of a builder who operates across the entire stack. I mean, he has the range to draft the Kubernetes job spec, build the Envoy proxy, write the OpenAPI validators, code the contract tests, design the customer-facing UI, and then turn around and write the promotion case for a direct report, all in the same week.
That's crazy.
For a top-tier AI platform, you do not just need an engineer who can prompt an LLM to do something cool.
No, you need an architect who can build the safety substrates, the evaluations, and the control planes that make agentic systems commercially viable and safe for highly regulated customers. You need someone who knows how to design and operate the factory floor, not just someone who brought a really fast power drill.
This raises an important question, though, and I really want to leave you, the listener, with a final thought to mull over as you evaluate your team's needs.
Let's hear it.
In Jeremy's notes on what still needs work in the Agentic SDLC, he introduces this concept called trust calibration.
Trust calibration.
Yeah. He points out that the next frontier isn't just making models smarter or context windows larger. The next frontier is building a system where a coding agent actually recognizes its own limitations.
What does that actually look like in practice?
Imagine a high-risk pull request generated by an agent. Instead of just throwing it to a human for review, the agent actually stops itself during the drafting phase.
Oh, wow.
It looks at the repository history and says, I can write this feature, but historically, changing this authentication module causes severe regressions in the billing API. So I'm going to explicitly pause and ask a human architect for a design decision before I proceed.
That is wild. The code doubting itself based on historical context and risk profiles.
Exactly. So the challenge for you is this. As you build out your frontier AI teams, what does the future of your engineering floor look like? Are you just hiring people who can make AI do things? Or are you hiring architects who can build systems that actually teach the AI when to doubt itself?
That is the difference between an autocomplete trick and real engineering. And when you are dealing with production AI, you really, really need the engineer.